Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hello and welcome to Future Projection. This is episode 138 of the show. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined by Ben Badler. What's up, Ben?
I'm good, Carlos. No late season collapses on this end, for us at least.
No, we're going strong down the stretch, unlike a few teams that seem to be falling apart. Man, I love fall baseball in general, and we're officially in fall now. I think this is our first fall episode this season. The weather is starting to turn for me, and it is really fun to just watch baseball that matters down the stretch. And this Cleveland-Detroit series was very hyped at the beginning of this week. And I feel like it's, in terms of like the competitiveness of the games and how close they were, it's been a lot of fun to watch. But man, Detroit, it's been tough sledding for them, and maybe tough sledding for some other teams and maybe the opposite direction, which is kind of a fun thing to talk through as well. But
it's funny because
BA is plugging along.
But if you looked at the beginning of the season and said, okay, here's what the standings are going to be in the NL Central on September 25th, you'd be like, yeah, that looks right.
Mm-hmm.
But
got there.
not the route we expected, or not the route we would have thought maybe a month or two ago. Or two weeks ago.
Like the playoff odds graph for that division probably looks insane. So my World Series prediction is at least at this point still alive. I had Brewers Guardians, I think, was my pick. And a month ago I would have said, oh, that's not gonna happen now. But at least for now it's still alive. Do you remember your pick was?
Probably Dodgers. I don't remember offhand. Did you really have Brewers though? Good for you.
I did. I mean,
we'll see once they get bounced after the first playoff round. But yeah.
There's not a real science that's going into who I'm picking for World Series picks. But I know at the beginning of the year, I was very much in the, I'm really pissed off that every baseball fan who's not a Dodgers fan is like writing off the season. And I was like, why don't I just pick some like lower profile, lower spending teams who I think are good every year? And if those teams get into the playoffs, they have as much a chance to win as the Dodgers do, because this is just the playoff system we're working with in baseball. And so I was like, okay, Brewers are always competitive. I'll choose the Brewers. I'm confident they're going to be good. Guardians, same kind of thought process there. I was like, let me just choose these like low budget teams and then laugh if it actually pans out that way. I mean, has anyone been talking about the Dodgers as a juggernaut to end competitiveness in baseball basically since a month into the season? The whole offseason, that was the narrative. The Dodgers are ruining baseball. And like, that has not been a thing the entire season. So I'm glad that that's the case.
And the Blue Jays have the better record.
Right. Yeah, it's just, I mean, I think the Brewers have the best record in baseball right now, correct?
I do remember the Brewers were my pick in our Crystal Ball series for the surprise pick or surprise team of the year. And I think I even wrote, it kind of feels like cheating, but I didn't understand why.
Yeah, the team that gets to the playoffs every single year is your surprise pick, Ben.
But when so many projections in the preseason, so many projection systems had them being like a 500 team, and I was like, I don't look at this lineup with like Bryce Turang and Jackson Churio and Sal Frelick and all these guys, and just what they do with pitching every year.
Mm-hmm.
You still have Freddie Peralta at the top. No, I didn't realize they were going to trade for Quinn Priester and he was going to pitch this way, and a lot of other things shook out right for them. I'm not going to sit here and say I thought they were the best team and we're going to be the best team in baseball, but Yeah, people picking against the Brewers. I don't know.
not looking good for them, although I guess, no. Like you said, we'll wait till the first round of the playoffs and see what happens. But, I mean, I also just like the fact that we have so many divisional races still alive. Right now in the American League, the Mariners have clinched the AL West. The Phillies have clinched the NL East. The Brewers have clinched the Central. All the other divisions are still up for grabs. And, I mean, the fact that the Padres have fought the Dodgers down to the wire, I think they're 2.5 games behind now, so probably unlikely that they can take that from them. But, I mean, I think it's a testament to them. And just, again, the parity of baseball that we see year in and year out. Although I guess the NL West would be the one division you could point to and say the Dodgers have just had such a stranglehold on it. I think it would be, I mean, I'm not rooting for any of these teams per se, but like for the narrative that I hated to see, it would be really funny if the year that we were all writing off the league to the Dodgers, they didn't even win the division and the Padres did. But that's neither here nor there. What else has been on your mind as we're kind of hit down the stretch here?
Connor Griffin, Baseball America Minor League Player of the Year. Congrats to Connor. It's I would not look. We ranked Connor Griffin the number one high school player in the country the moment he reclassified to the from 2025 to 2024 class. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we ever wavered off that.
Nope.
And as much as I think both you and I were fans of Connor Griffin, obviously by our rankings, I don't think either of us would have expected him to come and be the minor league player of the year. I mean, he has unbelievable, freakish, mutant-type athleticism, physicality, tools, but there were definitely questions about how the hitting ability would translate both right away and also at higher levels. And he just looks like a monster in the making right now.
Yeah, he absolutely does. I mean, to your point, he was always the top player on our high school rankings. His class, I think, was generally critiqued pretty heavily, just the talent level of the high school class that year by you, by me, by the industry. Like, we did not have a lot of high school hitters in that class that we were like really sold on. I don't think the depth of that class was very good. And I think now, I don't know if we mentioned this on our last podcast or if I mentioned it, but I've been thinking about like Connor Griffin's prospect stock now compared to a Bobby Witt Jr. Bobby Witt Jr. never ranked number one on our top 100 because we had both Julio Rodriguez and Adley Rutschman kind of up there vying for that top spot alongside him. It was always a pretty tight debate among that trio for us. But like Connor Griffin can say he is the top prospect in baseball. That's something that Bobby Witt Jr. couldn't say during his time in pro ball. But like thinking about where he is positioned now in the like prospect world, thinking about that compared to like where he was in high school and where Bobby Witt Jr. was in high school, I never would have said like Connor Griffin, yeah, I think he's got a chance to be a Bobby Witt Jr. caliber player. But I think what he's shown this year with just the progression he's made with the hit tool, like if that is your only question with Connor Griffin and he did what he did this year in high A and double A, I think you have a lot of confidence then that he can be that sort of franchise caliber player. Now, would I like to see him walk a little bit more? Yeah. Would I like to see him maybe continue to improve the approach? Yeah. But I think those are sort of nitpicks to the profile. Even Bobby Witt Jr., his first few years in the major leagues, I had some questions about how much was he going to walk or is he going to strike out too frequently? Like, is he going to have this sort of floor of on-base percentage that'll just allow him to be a really consistent offensive player in addition to being just a dynamic one with a power ability that is just game changing. But I mean, Connor Griffin does everything on the baseball field that you want to see from a premium up the middle athletic player. The defense has been better than I expected it to be at shortstop. I think to your credit, Ben, you were always very high on his defensive ability at shortstop. I was much more willing to move him to center field coming out of high school. And I thought just because of how well he moved and how the position generally is a little bit easier, I would say, for a player of his physicality. Although with all the shortstops we have of his sort of size now, I need to stop saying that because he looks great.
He's really good in center field too.
Right. So like, I mean, he has the sort of defensive ability at multiple positions that we don't see very frequently. So Donny Rafaela is maybe one of the only players I can think of, and his offensive upside and just physicality is in a different league compared to a guy like Rafaela. I mean, when I watch him play shortstop, it looks like a young Manny Machado to me. And I think Machado could have easily played shortstop a little bit longer at the early stages of his career. So I'll be curious to see just how the body develops. But mostly I'm excited to see when we're going to see him at the major league level, because it would shock me if he had a chance to debut as a 20-year-old. I mean, he's only played 21 games in Double A, but these sort of elite players are on a fast track in general, and I don't know that it would be off base to move him quickly. I mean, the Pirates desperately need some offense. I'm not sure how much further away you think that team is in terms of being able to compete in the NL Central, but with Paul Skeens and what he's doing in the rotation, a lot of the other arms they have, Bubba Chandler being ready to roll at the major league level next year, like I would be really, I wouldn't want to put any sort of leash on Connor Griffin. And yeah, I just think he's aced every single test that he's been given so far. And also, like, just watching him talk about winning the Player of the Year award for on our hot sheet, it was cool that he came on and kind of talked about his season and the adjustments he's made with his swing. If you guys haven't seen that, I would definitely recommend checking it out. He just seems like a very down-to-earth kid, and it's hard to not root for kids like that. So it's been really cool to see his season.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on the state of the Pirates in general right now? I mean, they definitely have pitching, and they have Paul Skeens, who's Paul Skeens is the best pitcher in baseball. He's 23 mm-hmm. years old. And Jared Jones, he's coming back. You've got Bubba Chandler, Mitch Keller. They have pitching. They really need bats, and mm-hmm. Connor Griffin looks spectacular, but man, I don't know. Otherwise, the state of hitting in their organization is, I mean, major league team and farm system is, outside of Connor Griffin, pretty abysmal.
Yeah, well, I do think that Edward Florentino has a chance to rise in our, I mean, right now we've got Connor Griffin, Bubba Chandler, Seth Hernandez, Edward Florentino on the top 100 from the Pirates system. It sounds like Florentino is going to make a pretty healthy jump this offseason. But that said, like, he's 18 years old. Mm-hmm. How far away is he going to be? Seth Hernandez, you're not helping out in the offensive side of things. He's probably years away as well. So these aren't guys, even if I really like them as prospects, they're not guys that you would anticipate are going to have an impact on the big league team in the near future, unless the Pirates just really get aggressive, maybe cashing in on that prospect value via trade, which I don't necessarily think they should do, just given how unwilling they've been to spend. But I look at this team and I'm like, hey, if you actually want to compete, you just cannot have a bottom five payroll. Like, there are ways you can make your team better if you actually want to go out and spend. And I don't think this ownership group has done anything to give us any confidence that they are going to actually make additions to this team from the outside, whether that's trading for players who have bigger salaries, whether that's signing free agents. Like, even if they are going to be competitive in terms of handing out money, like, why would a free agent want to go sign with a team that has not really ever shown a commitment to winning? And so I am a little bit skeptical as to, like, what the level of committing to win is going to be from a financial perspective. And like you said, there's not this core of young hitters like we saw with Baltimore, like we saw with the Red Sox, that can kind of come up and take their offense to the next level without spending. So I think there needs to be some sort of external addition, and I have no confidence that's going to happen here. So it might take a while, unless it's going to be, I could see the Pirates, if they make a lot of savvy moves kind of on the margins, having a sort of Kansas City-esque path to success, where you've got a good rotation, you have a couple people in your lineup where, if Griffin is the sort of player we think he can be, he's the focal point of the offense. Maybe you're not looking at like a top third offense in baseball, but you play defense well, you get some good additions in the bullpen. Like, I think most teams can make upgrades easier in the pen. We see kind of like what Cleveland is doing, actually. A lot of their success is just because they've got such a lights out bullpen, they're winning close games. So, like, they could be competitive, but I don't know. It's a long ways to go offensively for them.
Have they shown any signs of doing that, making those kind of savvy moves in the last 5-6 years? I mean, they're 29th in baseball in OPS plus. Mm-hmm. O'Neill Cruz has crazy power. He has speed. He's also hitting 201, 300, 381. Mm-hmm. Spencer Horwitz is one of those guys where that was a nice move. He is a nice player, but I think this pretty much is what he is. Otherwise, who are you optimistic about being a foundational piece of a playoff lineup in Pittsburgh? If you're a Pirates fan right now, to get there in the next few years, it's not Henry Davis. It's not, I don't think it's Nick Gonzalez. I don't think it's Nick York.
I was about to say, like, how much do we think Nick York has in the tank? Like, he's not showing a ton to get you too excited.
So, okay.
Like, yeah, again, I think it's external. You have, if it's beyond Connor Griffin in the next 2 or 3 years, I really think they have to go out and try and sign a free agent, try and sign a veteran that they know can produce and just help add a little bit of any sort of depth to this lineup.
Yeah, and the problem is I think every Pirates fan who's listening to this knows that's just not going to happen. Like, your owner is just not going to spend to fill in.
Yeah, and that sucks gaps. Because the Pirates, the park is awesome. The history of the team is very cool.
100%,
Like it should be a city, and it should be a franchise that has an owner that has actually committed to winning. And again, like,
it's a sleeping giant if they ever can get back to the playoffs.
Just get a different owner is basically the critique here. Like, you should not expect to win if you're running out of bottom five payroll in the game. Like, your commitment is to being one of the worst teams in baseball at that point. So, I mean, I don't know what to say. No, I don't expect them to compete anytime soon unless they're actually going to change on that side of things.
I agree.
I mean, there's some good, well-run teams in the division. I mean, most people bang on both central divisions for being less competitive. But, I mean, the Brewers, like we talked about, they are one of the best-run teams in the game. The Cubs, I think, are just willing to spend more money. They're better run. I actually think the Reds have a lot of young players that I'd be more optimistic from an offensive perspective to help bring them back to contention, in addition to having a pretty solid young homegrown pitching staff. I mean, the Cardinals have had a bad run of things recently. I think they're a little bit further away, but like no one who's following baseball is going to say they have less confidence in the Cardinals figuring things out than the Pirates, just given what these organizations have done historically. So I don't think the NL Central is some pushover division where you can just kind of get on a heater one year and sneak into the playoffs, even with 12 teams. Yeah.
Look, you're right. A lot of it is on ownership. At the same time, it's not all on ownership. Like, okay, the farm system for hitters, okay, Connor Griffin, A+ draft pick. But who else do they have for hitters, at least? Right. I mean, Tarmar Johnson, is he gonna be an average regular or better? Maybe. I wouldn't.
Yeah, Tarmar living up to his pre-draft expectations would maybe have made this conversation a lot easier to talk through, because like we thought Tarmar was going to be much better than what he actually was. But you look at the hitters they've taken at the very top of the draft. Connor Griffin looks to be a great win at number 9. But Tarmar Johnson, 4th overall, 2022. Henry Davis, 1st overall, 2021. I think that maybe is the pick you can critique the most of this recent run. Like, you could throw Nick Gonzalez in at 7. But I think Nick Gonzalez at 7 at the time, like, given the players who went in front, that pick to me made a lot of sense based on the board. Henry Davis is the one where, like, they very clearly targeted Henry Davis because of the signability aspect. And I always say this, like, you can't say you're going to get Bubba Chandler if you don't make this move with Henry Davis, but there was Marcelo Meyer, Jordan Lawler. There were other offensive options that we had at least ranked above Davis. Now, I'll acknowledge they were all in the same tier, so that was kind of a tricky class, I would say, to be drafting at the top. But yeah, like, I don't know. What's their last first-round hitter that you feel really excited about?
I mean, just even aside from the first-round hitters, where are the other hitters mm-hmm. in the farm system coming from that you think are going to be parts of the next Pirates playoff baseball team? I mean, you mentioned Edward Florentino. There's a lot to like as a hitter. Mm-hmm. He's still an 18-year-old who has 54 games at low A. Like, he's not coming up next year. Like, maybe in a perfect world scenario, he's up there when he's 20 years old in 2 years.
Right.
But probably not. Otherwise, I don't know. I don't see, like, help is not on the way, at least not for the lineup in the next couple years from either the draft or the international. Again, Florentino looks good. Connor Griffin, A-plus draft pick. But otherwise, like, I don't know. I don't blame ownership for the lack of hitting in the entire organization. But obviously, ownership is a big problem.
I mean, do you think the Pirates have this sort of imbalance between pitching talent and hitting talent to warrant trading one of these young pitchers and trying to reinforce in a trade, sort of like a less of a full rebuild White Sox trading Garrett Crochet for a few prospects? Like, are there any arms that you would target as saying, hey, like, you're really talented, but we probably have enough other arms here. We have a clear need in the offense. Like, do you think there's an avenue there that could maybe help them get to competitive before,
I don't know, 5 years from now? Last year, we talked about it with Jared Jones. Now, I don't think you're going to get the kind of value that you would have previously. So I don't know if that's worth it right now. But
yeah, it's unfortunate because, I mean, the last two seasons, just seeing what Paul Skenes has done and is doing, you said you think he's the best pitcher in baseball right now. For me, it's like it's him or Tarek Skubal. Pick whichever one you want. But 2 years with more than 130 innings, sub-2, ERA is insane. I mean, he added about 50 innings this year and he's still doing it. I mean, Paul Skenes is disgusting. I don't know how many years you can expect him to be pitching like this. And so to just not be fielding a competitive team around your homegrown ace when he is out here performing feels a bit like a waste. So I'm hopeful they can make something happen, because again, it would just be a lot of fun to see Paul Skenes pitch in the postseason, and we don't really look close to that right now.
Yeah, they're going to finish in last place in the NL Central. I'm curious what you think. If you look at all six last place teams, if you rank them out for best to worst or best future to worst in terms of most likely to get back to the postseason, become a playoff contender in the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years, how would you take those teams? So you've got the Pirates, you've got the White Sox, the Nationals, the Orioles, the Rockies, and the Angels.
Okay, well, the easy one for me to just throw into the closet and forget about them is the Rockies. I mean, I have no comp for worse. Like, yeah, they would be my least likely team. If we're saying which of these teams is going to make the playoffs first, which team has the best shot to get to the playoffs? I mean, the Rockies are having a historically terrible season. Their run differential right now, it was like stunning to see this. They have a minus 412 run differential. I did a quick search to see the worst run differentials of all time. Right now, according to StatMuse, they are sixth worst all time. The only other teams that are in front of them are all teams
so far,
from the 1800s, Ben. Like, we haven't seen it. This is crazy. The amount of runs they've allowed, they've already allowed more than 1,000 runs this year. The season's not over. Only one other time in their franchise history have they allowed more than 1,000 runs in a season. They allowed 1,028 in 1999. The fewest amount of runs scored, if you're not counting 1994 and 2020, which are shortened seasons because of the strike and because of COVID, this will be the fewest runs they've ever scored in a full season, and it's not even close. In 2025, they've scored 589 runs. Their second fewest runs scored, 682 from last year in 2024. Like, almost 100 runs worse is insane. So yeah, this team is pretty brutal. We've got Ethan Holliday and we've got Charlie Condon on the top 100. Both are players who, I mean, their stock has only gone down since they've been picked. So I still have confidence they can be something, but there are a whole lot of problems here with the Rockies, and they're in a really tough division. So let's just table them.
Yeah, they're last in the league in OPS plus, second to last in ERA plus.
It's a disaster.
Yeah. I mean, and you're looking for reasons to be optimistic about the major league team.
I have none. None?
You like Chase Dolander?
I love Chase Dolander, and I'm sad that he has to pitch in Coors Field half the time now. Like, it's so brutal.
Yeah, him. I still like Ezekiel Tovar. Hunter Goodman is solid. Those are like their young guys. otherwise, that's
no,
yeah, you know, and I don't love the farm system, and yeah. Now they're not going to pick until 10th overall.
Yep,
in the 2026 draft, because
which
just
by the way, I think is great addition to the rules.
Just twisting the knife into the backs of the
try to win here. Try to win. There's no path to just being terrible and getting good.
It's tough too, because the last time they played in a postseason game was 2018, and they've had a losing record. It's been either fourth or fifth place in the division every year, seven straight years. I mean, they're going to finish with, 43, 44, 45 wins if they finish strong. When the Orioles bottomed out as a 47-win team in 2018, it still took them five more seasons to get to the playoffs. The Astros, when they had they won 56 games, they got to the playoffs 4 years later. But with the Rockies, it's not a new regime coming in to take over and implement a different philosophy with new management and new decision making process. So yeah, I agree. I have them ranked as the least likely of these teams to get back to the playoffs in the next few years.
Yeah. So if we just kind of keep going least likely to most, the next team I would probably pick would be the White Sox. I think they're still a bit off. So they would maybe be next. After that, I might honestly go Angels. I just have no confidence. They've been like spinning their wheels for feels like a decade now. They continue to like not really restock the farm system in the same way that like I feel like they should have at this point. I have more confidence in teams like the Mariners, the Astros, the Rangers, the A's. Like I'm much more bullish on what the A's are going to be like in the next few years versus the Angels, just given the sort of young position players on that team. Like Mike Trout is not the same Mike Trout that he used to be. You can't rely on him just carrying them. And even in Mike Trout peak years, like it's baseball. You can't LeBron James your way to the playoffs. So they would probably be next after the White Sox for me. Are your 5 and 4 similar here?
I would have the same order, I think. Yeah. Okay. Angel or White Sox 5 and then Angels 4. Yep. Yeah. Angels, man, they haven't been in the playoffs since 2014 and they haven't had a winning record since 2015. I just don't see anything changing. I mean, Zach Neto, great. Taylor Ward, good player. He's 31 years old, though. Trout is, like you said, he's 34. They've patched together a decent starting rotation, but it's an older group. They do have Tyler Bremner coming up, Caden Dana coming up. Overall, though, the farm system isn't that good. It's interesting lower-level guys, but I just don't have a lot of optimism about turning this thing into a playoff team in the next couple of years.
Yeah, the next one for me, 3 versus 2, I think is
what about what about the White Sox?
I just think they're far away. I mean, their team right now is not compelling. I do think they have an interesting few players at the top of their system. I just think it's going to take a while for them to get competitive.
Yeah, I think you've got Edgar Caro, Kyle Teal. Like that's a strong catching group. Colton Montgomery has been surprisingly a 3-WAR player this year, at least according to BREF, despite a sub 300 OBP. But I do think he's a pretty high probability to be a regression candidate going forward. Like Miguel Vargas is okay. Like Chase Mydroth is like a decent low end.
It's probably worth just sitting there on that Colson Montgomery comment. And that feels like a win for him, just given how rough it's been for the last 2 years in the minors. Like, the injuries, the strikeout concerns, like being sent back down. I mean, Fangraphs has him as a 2.1 win player in 67 games, so not quite as bullish as Baseball Reference, but in basically a little less than half the season, that's a really great result for a player that I don't know, a lot of people probably wrote off entirely at some stage here. So yeah, we'll see if he can build on that. He's still only 23 years old, so yeah, some things to like, I think, compared to the first two teams we talked about, where it really just feels a little more hopeless. You can kind of point to a few players that you're excited about, and the talent in the system starts to get a little bit more interesting. I do think like picking the third and second teams are the trickiest here for me, because I have a clear number one. I'm not sure where you're at, but for me, the next two I'm deciding between are the Pirates and the Nationals. I could see cases for both of those being third. Like, I am pretty compelled by some of the young major league players on the Nationals, guys like James Wood, Jacob Young, I think Dylan Cruz. I'm hopeful that with a healthy season, he can kind of become more of the player I expected him to be. You need a lot more reinforcements in the starting rotation around Mackenzie Gore, like we've talked about on a few podcasts recently, and he's quickly getting to the end of his service time. So, like, is he going to be a part of that competitive team? Is he going to be traded off to help reinforce this young core? With their recent draft, I think it's going to be a lot of players who are a lot further away. I mean, three or four of their top players are high school picks that I don't think in the near future have a chance to impact the team. But I do think there are enough, like, established, in quotes, big leaguers who I could see taking steps forward to help push this team to a competitive season with some savvy pickups, with some additions to the pitching staff. And then we talked about the Pirates, like, they just need so much help offensively. I feel like they're kind of both in a maybe a similar spot where they have some clear weaknesses that need to be addressed. And a lot of it's just going to depend on how much of a commitment you get from ownership. I'd be more excited about probably the Nationals now, just given some of the changes in the front office, given at least what the ownership has done in the past, in Washington compared to Pittsburgh. So I would probably go Pittsburgh 3 and Washington 2. How about you?
I had the same order. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're in lockstep here.
The Nationals, we talked a lot last episode, but you got James Wood, CJ Abrams, Dalen Lyle, you know, Dylan Cruz and Brady House coming up now, Jacob Young, Luis Garcia still in their mid-20s. You got to trade Mackenzie Gore. I think he'll be maybe the most valuable trade chip of the offseason. They just hired a new GM, or I mean, he's going to be president.
I think president of baseball operations, yep. Paul Taboni from the Red Sox.
I'm sure he's smart enough to realize they need to trade Mackenzie Gore now and capitalize on his peak trade value. But that just the pitching needs a lot of help. It's kind of the opposite problem as the Pirates have. But I think the lineup is in a much better state. There's a new management team coming in that I think you'd be optimistic about. You know, we'll see who else they put in place. But the thing is, the farm system is just it's light for a team that's been in rebuild mode for such a long time. And we talked last time about, like, okay, like Travis Zecora, Harlene Susanna, we saw good things from them this year, and they both had major arm operations that scare the heck out of me. And beyond them, like, okay, like Eli Willett's obviously a good player, but
pretty far away, I'd imagine, at least 3 years away. And that seems like optimistic for the youngest ever won one. He's still 17 years old. He needs to get a lot more physical. He just needs more pro experience. Alexander Clemmy, another of their top prospects, we both think there's a lot of reliever risk. So, like, how much are you relying on him to drive the rebuild? And then a lot of their other prospects who are in the top 10 are either high school players who are just drafted, Coy James, pitchers like Landon Harmon, Miguel Cime, or guys who are, I think, coming off really questionable seasons. Seaver King, a pick that you did not like in real time, a pick that was a little bit further off the board. I think we had him around 17 or so. The Nationals take him 10. His season's not great. Caleb Lomavita kind of rounding out their top 10 right now. Some offensive questions there. So, yeah, you don't have – I don't know how much we'd be talking about this differently if Harlene Susanna and Zecora had clean bills of health, because I do think those guys have a chance to be impact arms in a rotation. But that's not the reality now that you're working with. So, yeah.
And I think as much as I think a lot of Nationals fans are disillusioned with their ownership group, I would very much take it over Pittsburgh or Angels easily. Or the White Sox. I mean, the Rockies, that's the common thread that all these teams at the very bottom.
Yeah. I mean, it's boring ownership to say, but often that's just the easiest answer. It's like you have a crappy owner. It's hard to, I mean, it's not impossible, but it makes everything harder. It's just the reality.
I wouldn't bucket the Nationals into that group. And I think, look, historically, we've seen I think the Nationals are more willing to spend than some of these other clubs. Absolutely. When their club gets closer to a competitive window.
Yeah. And so, unsurprisingly, I guess that leaves Orioles. We both have the most confidence in them figuring things out, getting to the playoffs sooner. I mean, in two of the last three seasons, they made the playoffs, even if they are at the bottom. I feel like it's almost always easiest to just choose whoever is at the bottom of the AL East, because all these teams are pretty competitive year in, year out, and someone has to be fifth. So, I mean, I'm still pretty excited about their core of position players. I really wish they would have addressed pitching in a better way this past offseason. I do think they've got a lot of players in the farm system who I'm excited about moving forward. Again, I don't know if there's like an obvious arm. I mean, you still have, I need to pull up their list, but yeah, I think they have better like near-term reinforcements than all the other teams we're talking about here. Let me pull it up. Yeah, same with Bisaya. I guess maybe it starts and ends with Bisaya. We're counting him, right? Is he?
I guess, yeah, if you kind of count him as a prospect. Yeah, he's, you know, he's coming up now. He's still a prospect, though.
Is he going to be in the prospect handbook, or does he have a chance to graduate?
I'll have to check. I think he's still
on LCD. He's at 111 plate appearances. We do at bats. He's at 102 at bats. He should be good. I mean, so yeah, we're talking about a top 10 overall hitting prospect in the game. That carries a lot of weight for me. And if we're going to just say, like, he's kind of already there, that's fine. But I'm still thinking of him as, like, a reinforcement. Maybe that's just a...
2025 just feels like more of a one-year blip to me for the Orioles than anything else. I mean, you got Gunnar Henderson, one of the best players in baseball. Mm-hmm. Adley Rutschman does need to turn things around.
Yeah, like hopefully it's just a health issue with him. Like, he got hit in the hand and then kind of fell off a cliff after that, so...
Yeah. You know, Jackson Holliday is... Man, people like are real quick to write off, like, you know, like if Jaron Duran or Geraldo Perdomo, like these guys didn't hit right away when they got to the big leagues. Jackson Holliday is 21 years old. He's the same age as Ivar Kidd or, you know, Ike Irish, Caden Bodine, like these guys, the Orioles, all these college hitters who just were drafted this year.
Yeah.
I think he still has a very bright future. Basai, you talked about, is coming up right now. Jordan Westberg, my guy Dylan Beavers, Colton
I just think
Cowder,
they've got a deep, deep young lineup, and there a lot of them are very young. Like you mentioned with Jackson, still developing. You could probably bank on a better year for Adley next year with health. Like, there's just a lot of up arrow movement I could see with basically the entirety of this lineup next year. And again, if you just like address some of the questions in the starting rotation in a way that is not like 35 plus year old pitchers who throw like 90 miles an hour, this team could be a solid competitor immediately. So I think they're the pretty easy top pick here for this discussion.
Yeah, I could see the Orioles getting to the playoffs next year. I don't think this is some long turnaround. The lineup is there.
Yep.
The pitching is fixable. It's just like you look internally, I don't know, like, I mean, Esteban Mejia is a really promising young arm. He's not going to help him next year. So you're just going to have to find that. Like, that's where the savvy moves are going to have to come from that we talked about, that like the Pirates need to make with hitters. That's what the Orioles need to do. But I think it's easier to find those players on the margins when you're looking at pitching compared to hitters. Like, you know, the Brewers have consistently done that. Can the Orioles replicate or find their own success stories like that? I don't know. They need to start doing it.
Trying to think or look at the top starting pitching options this offseason.
Trade for Mackenzie Gore.
There you go.
A nice big Nationals Orioles trade. That'd be fun.
That would be a lot of fun, yeah. I would like to see that. I mean, I just want to see these fun young pitchers in the postseason. So whatever path allows that to happen, I'll be all aboard. Zach Gallen is a free agent. He's the most exciting arm I'm seeing now, just kind of looking through the list of players who are available.
Would you be willing to trade Basayo if you could get Mackenzie Gore?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I mean, we just talked through how exciting their lineup is. I think rotation is an area that needs to be addressed. I think Mackenzie Gore is potentially an ace. Maybe you already bucket him there. Why not? I mean, Sam Basayo is a really good player. Mackenzie Gore is a really good pitcher. I think it's harder to find frontline starters than it is middle of the order bats. So yeah, I definitely would. And he's probably in the peak of his powers right now. Just next, we got two, three more years of control for him.
Two more years, yeah.
Yeah, two more. I could see some people like looking at six more years of Basayo versus two more years of Gore and thinking that's a little bit of an overpay, again, we're pretty bullish on what he's going to be offensively. So maybe you need something else. But I would
that it hurts tells me it's not a unfair trade. Like everybody wants to offer all their like C tier or like B tier prospects.
Yeah, and get,
you know, the best player.
Yeah, 10 dimes not equal a dollar
on the market. I mean, the Red Sox got Garrett Crochet without having to give up Meyer, Campbell, or Roman Anthony.
They also gave up four pretty good prospects. So
sure. Yeah, like, yeah, that's if I'm the Orioles, maybe I'm trying to do that instead.
Right.
If I'm the Nationals and the Orioles come calling and wanted to do that and do these complimentary pieces and want me to throw Kobe Mayo or whatever into that deal, I'm saying, hey, the A's just got Leo Dallas DeVree for Mason Miller. Like, he's a reliever.
I mean, maybe if you are the Nationals, you could say, hey, a guy like Nate George, a guy like Kobe Mayo, a guy like Esteban Mejia, like all those guys,
right?
Maybe they line up with your timeline a little bit better. Yeah, I could see that being more appealing from Baltimore's side of things for sure. And maybe I'm not saying like the Nationals would prefer Bisaio, but it would make sense to me to just get a lot of young talent that maybe you think aligns more with your realistic window to compete. That could make sense.
I think they'd rather have Bisaio.
I would too. Yeah. Yeah, I would. Okay. We're getting closer to knowing draft lottery order, at least, Ben. You want to talk through that since we're busy talking about some of the worst teams in baseball here today?
Yeah. Is that what you're glued to for the end of the season, Carlos, when you're watching baseball? Everybody else is watching these series with playoff implications, and you're watching like what the Braves could be, how they could end their season. Are they gonna end up increasing their draft lottery chances? Or there's some close ones here that can make a significant difference. Obviously it's not set in stone of like, okay, now we finish with the fourth worst record in baseball, we pick fourth overall. It's not like that, but it still swings, still tilt the probabilities in your favor if you tank out the rest of the season.
Yeah, I can't say that I'm like watching the bottom of the standings, like getting really excited when Atlanta falls from 4 to 5 in the lottery odds rankings. It is, I think, an interesting little wrinkle to the end of the season. I mean, if you're a Braves fan, are you ticked right now? Then the last 10 games, they've gone 9-1. I think they were on like a 9-game winning streak you'd mentioned before the podcast and have lost some slight chances for the number one overall pick. I mean, we just wrote a piece the other day breaking down Rock Chalowski and why he maybe is the most complete college shortstop prospect we've seen in the draft in a decade. And it does seem like a lot of people who are fans of teams that have a chance for the first overall pick are excited about the possibility of getting him. It does seem like if your season's kind of lost, you would just prefer having better odds than having a few more wins.
Yeah, and the bonus pool advantages that come with it. Yeah, I mean, if you're the Braves, especially the Braves scouting director or Braves scouting department, you're like, man, we just had this dreadful, like one of the worst seasons we've had in a long, long time. And now to finish the season, we go, they had a 9-game winning streak. They're 75 and 84, so they're like in the fifth spot where, I mean, the gap between five, like if you have the fifth best chances in the lottery, your odds are of the number one pick are 6.55%.
I think roughly for all these percentages, because if you're using like MLB Tankathon's percentage, I think they're pretty close, but I'm not exactly sure how MLB proportions out the odds that teams. So teams like Colorado, Washington, and the Los Angeles Angels, they are not eligible. So the odds they would have gotten are proportionally assigned to every other team. And I tried to run the math myself last year, and I'm not exactly sure how MLB does it, but when they sent out their official odds, it was slightly off what Tankathon is. So these aren't the exact, I don't believe, unless they fix however they're doing it. The MLB rules is reasonably vague on how this happens. But either way, like,
the gap between 5 and 2 is roughly, let's say, 15 to 16 percentage points. So had they just played like they had played the entire season,
right?
Be in a much given better position to go rock bottom.
given the fact that like the Rockies are ineligible this year, it does seem like Chicago is kind of in a league of their own in terms of it would have been hard for anyone to track them down for like 27-28% odds for a first overall pick. But really everyone from 2 to 7 or 8 or so, maybe even 9, like they're reasonably close together, just considering what you could have done in the last month. But right now, as we're looking at the odds, the White Sox are in the top spot, followed by the Twins, the Pirates, the Orioles, the Braves, the A's, the Marlins, and the Rays and the Giants. And then the Rockies, the Nationals, and the Angels will be 10, 11, and 12, just kind of how this works now. MLB Tankathon does have a draft lottery simulator. I clicked on that and ran it just for fun. The Pirates wound up with the first overall pick in my simulation that I clicked on. So imagine the Pirates adding Rock Chulowski to this Connor Griffin. That'd be a fast moving college player, help out the offense. That'd be great for them.
That would change the that might change my calculations.
Jump them over the Nationals.
Yeah. So the Rockies can't. They'll pick. So they will pick 10th. It's not even like
yes, they're so they far. Will, they will pick 10th because they of the three teams that are ineligible, you can't pick before 10. And so you basically just get 10 because the first six picks are your lottery picks.
Because after they picked fourth and third the last two years.
Yeah. So how it works basically is if you are a revenue receiver, I believe if you get paid out money in revenue sharing, you can have a lottery pick 2 years in a row. If you pay into revenue sharing, so you're a bigger market team, you cannot pick back-to-back times in the lottery. So the Nationals pick in the lottery, they can't pick again. Colorado picked twice in the lottery, they can't do it 3 years. So I think that little wrinkle is stupid. I would rather just be, you can't pick three consecutive times, you can't pick two, whatever it is, but we got to make things complicated in baseball's draft. So yeah, the Rockies will be 10, the Nationals will be 11, the Angels will be 12. I don't think there's a chance for the Nationals and the Angels to flip in that order, and Colorado is definitely locked into 10.
So the White Sox will have the highest odds around 27-28%. They're very far ahead of every other team in the race, given that the Rockies are glued to number 10.
Yes, correct. So the original odds, the bottom three teams in terms of the order all have the same odds as how it works to start, and then you factor in all the teams that can't pick.
But the bottom three teams, if you didn't have those rules that the Rockies and Nationals were picking 10 and 11, the bottom three teams otherwise would be 1 Colorado, 2 the White Sox, and then three the Nationals.
Right.
So two of the top three are going to be picking 10 and 11.
Yeah, for a second there, I was wondering, like, where's our third team? And did not realize that the Nationals would have been a bottom three team, and Minnesota would be fourth overall. So yeah, it goes 16.5% is the original odds for the top three, 13.2% for four, 10% for five, and then everyone else is sub 10%. It kind of goes down as you go throughout all the 18 non-postseason teams.
Yeah, so there's a big gap between, or a reasonable size gap between 2 and 3, and especially between 2 and 4. So you've got the end of the season right now. I mean, as of today, Twins are 2 at 68-90. The Pirates are only one game behind them, I guess, so to speak, looking at it from this perspective, at 69-89. And they've won 4 games in a row, the Pirates have. So. Tough.
Yeah, Pirates, Braves.
Paul Skenes is like
Athletics, Marlins. The Pirates.
Some,
all these teams are just winning too much. I mean, the White Sox are kind of just doubling and tripling, quadrupling down. They're 1-9 in their last 10. Twins are 3-7 in their last 10. Really, it's a bit of a shame to see, but the teams locked in at the 10 to the 12 spots who are not eligible, they've also all been pretty bad down the stretch. 2-8 for the Rockies and the Angels, 3-7 for the Nationals. I might be actually going out to Nationals Park this weekend to watch some.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Nationals, White Sox, man, just to get some real high-quality baseball in person to round out the Major League season for me. So it'd be more fun, I guess, if there was a race for actual draft lottery odds between the two. But
yeah, so Pirates and Twins, I mean, there's a difference of 5.5 percentage points for their number one pick odds, depending on which team finishes with the worst record. And then what is it? So you've got between from four through six, especially like the Orioles at four, mm-hmm. Braves at five, A's at six. Orioles are 74-84, Braves 75-84, A's 75-83. There's another close to 5 percentage difference, mm-hmm. percentage points difference between those spots. Again, not a huge amount, but if one of those teams goes down this the next few games, they'll tilt the odds a little bit in their favor.
You know what I think is interesting here is we're looking at these odds. Like, the A's are one of the teams that I feel like has gotten really unlucky in the draft lottery in recent years. In 2023, they got sixth overall. They had better odds than that. I mean, that year in particular maybe kind of sucked for them, just given the top five, but they got Jacob Wilson. That pick looks really good. Then in 2024, they also, their draft lottery odds were better than fourth overall. They wind up getting fourth. So they've moved down both of the years they're eligible for the lottery. Their fourth overall pick in 2024 was Nick Kurtz. Probably feel pretty good about that one right now. 2025, they were not eligible, so they picked 11th. So I think, like, despite getting quote-unquote unlucky with, like, where they're picking with how the draft lottery worked, the A's have really had a number of nice picks in this stretch. So maybe they're due some karma. Maybe they'll leap up the board here in the draft lottery this year instead of missing out. Because right now they're on that sixth line. And again, like, there are six teams who win a lottery. So technically teams like the Reds at 15, the Texas Rangers at 16, teams with like 1% odds or less that still have a chance to get up here and then move some of these other teams down. That happened when we saw the Guardians picking first, the Reds picking second, like, just teams we're not expecting at all jumping up the board. But I do think, just in terms of how unlucky the A's have been in the lottery, they're probably due some karma here. Maybe they'll be a sneaky number one.
Yeah, so the Braves-Pirates series to finish the season right now, 3-5 in terms of odds, that's got to be the big one.
Here's a little tanking, little draft lottery tanking series. Do we know who the probables are for that series?
Well, Skeens just threw.
So I guess that's good news for the Pirates. Got his start out of the way.
even if he comes up again, they should probably just shut him down.
You know, it's a great year.
Cy Young is already his.
Yeah. Save some bullets for when we're competing. Yeah. Yeah, it's odd to see the Braves here. A few years ago, it was like weird seeing the Cardinals up this high. The Braves haven't picked this high in a long time. I'm actually gonna pull up their draft history and see when's the last time they've really picked. I think it was like when they took Shea Langeliers top 10. Am I missing a draft for them? Yeah, so just going back in their drafts from 2025 for the last few years, they picked 22nd this year, Tate Southesine. 2024, they took Cam Caminiti at 24th overall. Same draft slot in 2023, Hurston Waldrip. 2022, picking 20th, Owen Murphy. 2021, 24th overall, they took Ryan Cusick. 2020, 25th overall, they took Jared Schuster. So the last time they picked top 10 was the 2019 draft, where they had both the 9th overall pick, which was compensation for not signing Carter Stewart in 2018. 8th overall, they took Shea Langeliers with that pick, and they took Braden Shoemake 21st overall in that 2019 draft. So it's been a while. Obviously, the Braves have been really competitive at the top of the NL East for a number of years now. This is one of their worst years in the last seven or so years. So these nods, they're going to be – actually, I don't know if they're guaranteed to be picking top 10. They should be. If it's not guaranteed, it would be really, really unlikely for them to slide all the way out. But, yeah, that's a team that I'm going to be fascinated to see, like, what sort of their strategy. It's hard to decipher, like, strategies any given year just because sometimes the board kind of lays out what you do. But this past year, going to that hitter demographic a little bit earlier compared to what they've done before that. And, yeah, so they're kind of the team I'm looking at and saying, you know, we haven't seen you up here recently.
I think the 2026 draft is really strong overall, mm-hmm. especially on the high school side. And when you have a player like Rock Chulaski, who right now is a favorite to go 1-1, let's say Rock Chulaski lives up to expectations. He basically just plays the way he did his sophomore year when he was the college player of the year. Mm-hmm. Let's say he looks as advertised, everything stays on track for him. Which team, if they were to get the number one pick, would Rock Chulaski, I mean, he's going to make an impact obviously for any team he plays mm-hmm. for, but like which team would it be the biggest, he'd be the biggest difference maker for, like, you know, like if Baltimore picks number one, it's like, okay, like we have Gunnar
yeah,
Anderson.
We have three other shortstops here. Yeah.
A lot of other good players still. Yep. I imagine they would still take him.
Right.
Just because of how good he is and figure everything out.
He just made me think, are we going to have the same old, like, your team can have other good shortstops conversation with Rock Chulaski? God, I mean, please let it be a team that needs a big league shortstop so we don't have to do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the other options right now, at least at the top of the draft, would be high school shortstops.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's all high schools. Like, not Rock, okay, Grady Emerson.
So
yeah, I mean, I think we're talking about the Braves. They've had a need at shortstop for a few years now. They don't have any obvious internal replacements. Their system has been super pitching heavy. I think they're starting to get to the point where they need some offensive reinforcements on this club. A lot of their guys are getting older, have had some injury issues. Shortstop is like one of the weakest spots in their lineup. So I think both in terms of like, is there a clear hole for you to fill for a player who could move quickly, like a Nick Kurtz sort of move, like a Wyatt Langford sort of move. Like we shouldn't be surprised when Rock moves extremely rapidly, like all these recent college players, like the Braves make mm-hmm. a ton of sense. We're talking about how Pittsburgh is pretty happy with Connor Griffin. Like the fact that he can move to center field and be great is awesome, but there's a little bit of a redundancy there. And I think if you're Rock, you're looking at Pittsburgh and you're like, I don't have confidence they're going to compete. Now, maybe you think you're kind of the piece to help add to that offense and lead them back to contention. But like, it's really, for me, it's like Braves and maybe the Twins, depending on how bullish you are of the teams in like the top six. Those would be the teams that if I'm Rock and I want to go and I want to win and compete in the postseason, those are probably the two teams I'm looking at. What about you?
If I'm Rock Chulaski and I want to go to a playoff team, that's a different question. I think.
Oh, my bad. That was how I read your question. I must have misunderstood.
I mean, like which team does Rock Chulaski make the biggest swing for? Where like, okay, like right, like if you put him in the Orioles, that's where right. he has the best chance of going to the playoffs.
But yeah. I see. I think it's either the White Sox or the Pirates because we're just talking about how the Pirates desperately need more offense. Regardless of if you got two shortstops, you're going to figure out where they're going to play. If the bat is what he flashed as a sophomore, it's a great addition to your team. And I just think the White Sox need just more talent. So I think those two teams are the teams that I would point to. I think more than any other.
I would say the Braves you mentioned too. They have the worst shortstop offense in baseball mm-hmm. this year. I think he would make
yeah. And again, like
be a perfect fit. For
you
them.
Look at their farm system right now. There's not a clear replacement on the way. I mean, maybe you think Alex Lodice is going to move really quickly. There's some things he needs to clean up offensively. Tate Southesine, I mean, he's a high school shortstop. I think even with those two players, them taking players at that position, like Chulaski, if he was taken a year from now, would immediately jump them in terms of like players that you expect to get to the majors and be competitive. Obviously, it's a different sort of like talent tier. We're talking about the first overall pick versus guys who went back half of the first round, second round. But like internally, John Hill is interesting, but he's still young. He's not proven at the double A, triple A level. Like there are not a lot of shortstop bats in the system that you can feel confident about in the near future to the degree that, that Rock Chulowski would be.
No, yeah, I would say them. Yeah, the White Sox would be a big one. The Pirates, I'd be curious if the Pirates were to draft him, like what would they then do with him and Connor Griffin? Because probably, I mean, Connor Griffin's going to get to the big leagues before Rock Chulowski, even though he's younger, just because he's there now, or just because he's in the Pirate system now, he's going to be in, at minimum, he's going to finish next year in AAA. He's probably going to get to the big leagues. They're going to put him at shortstop.
Right.
So then if you draft him and Rock Chulowski, the fact that like once you already have one guy there first, like that guy typically tends to stay there.
That's what I was thinking.
But Rock is
such a good defender, and I get the easiest answer is like how they play will kind of sort itself out if you had that issue. But again, looking at Connor Griffin's frame and looking at just like his ability to impact the game at a number of other positions, like Rock has some exposure at third base. He played third base for UCLA in deference to Cody Schreier a year ago at UCLA, which is kind of funny to think about. Like either of them could play third base easily. Like players of their skill at shortstop, like there's nothing that they're not going to be able to do for you at third base I wouldn't have any questions about either of them playing third. So I think it would just be a question of like, what is going to make your team the best defensive alignment? Like if Connor Griffin turns out to be this sort of impact defender, I mean, I expect Rock Chulowski to be that. I think at the same stage of their amateur career, even if we're going back to like what was Rock Chulowski in high school, I think he's a better defensive shortstop. So I don't think it's really an issue. I think Connor Griffin's skill set maybe lends itself towards other positions, and I just think Rock is a better shortstop defender, so I would lean towards him playing the position, and you play Connor wherever else. I mean, I think Connor even said, like, center field comes more naturally to him. I don't know if I don't know if that means he wants to play center field or would prefer to play there, but I think these are just issues that you don't really have to think too strongly about, because ultimately you normally don't really have that issue because someone doesn't pan out or they just play themselves to the position that makes the most sense. So I don't know. They would figure it out.
Yeah, no, I would definitely still take Rock Chulowski one and figure it out.
Yeah.
But just kind of thinking through, because you could put Griffin in center. You could put Griffin at third base. Like I think he'd be a gold glove defender if you put him at third base.
Right.
Or you could put one of them at shortstop, one of them at second base.
O'Neill Cruz playing in the corner outfield probably is fine, right? Like you're not going to be too worried about that if you got Connor Griffin running around at center, Rock Chulowski playing shortstop. Like,
or hope he bounces
take that
back and trade O'Neill Cruz, maybe just given how volatile he's been. But
So yeah, I think actually the most compelling team to get the first overall pick is Pittsburgh. They immediately become a lot more interesting to talk through in terms of like a dynamic homegrown pitching rotation fronted by arguably the best pitcher in the world in Paul Skeens, the top overall prospect in baseball in Connor Griffin, who was a high school player of the year, minor league player of the year. Looks like he's going to be just an impact bat, and then adding one of the better college prospects. Again, we'll see what happens in the spring. There's a chance he could fall on his face or regress a little bit or get hurt. Like all sorts of things can happen. But I'd say at this stage, he's in the sort of like Dylan Cruz sort of 1-1 position on our board. And maybe the fact that Dylan Cruz has not panned out right now is just a reminder that all these prospects are question marks. We never truly know what's going to happen with them. But I've talked myself into, again, not rooting for anything really, but Pittsburgh getting the first overall pick would be a lot of fun.
I would throw the teams in the top nine in there, I would throw the Rays into that group too. I think they need a lot more out of their shortstop position, and I don't like Carson Williams.
You've never been a big Carson Williams believer, have you?
He's really good defender. Man, I just don't have a lot of conviction, or certainly not as much as other people do.
I mean, his stock has fallen quite a bit this year, so I'm not sure where everyone is at with him, but he's like towards the back half of our top 100 currently. after ranking as like a top 15 overall prospect in the game entering the year. So, I mean, still all the same questions about how much contact is he going to make, the strikeout concerns, just the pure hit tool questions with him are there. So I think it'd be pretty boring if the Rays moved up to the first overall pick, to be honest. I feel like that would not be very compelling to me. I think I'd rather see someone like Miami. They need an infusion of offense as well. I think more so than the Rays, but
the draft lottery is at the winter meetings this year in December.
Yeah, I don't know if we have the exact date right now, but that's kind of been like the day before the Rule 5 draft. So I'd assume it's going to be then. Yeah. So, I mean, I wish the lottery itself was a little bit more interesting to watch. I feel like the actual TV product has been kind of just confusing the last few years. Like, I don't feel like it's very clear what's actually happening as the lottery goes on, but whatever. People just want to know what the order is, so I don't think that's a huge issue. Making the TV product of the draft lottery as good as possible.
I think that's ever going to be a big draw.
Yeah, I mean, I would like for them to have Jim Callis on or something, so we could actually talk about the players that we're talking about here that are at stake potentially. Like, we should be probably talking about the 2026 class. But it is always fun watching some of the scouting people on TV trying to not be uncomfortable with the cameras on them. That's always entertaining. So, yeah, we'll have that to look forward to. Okay, Ben, how about thoughts on the ABS Challenge system officially coming to the major leagues in 2026? We had that news earlier this week. JJ wrote a little bit about what we should expect, maybe some misconceptions of the ABS Challenge system. I'm a huge fan. I think I'm just generally excited overall for this edition. We saw a few calls in the last few days that I can't wait to see when hitters and pitchers are going to be able to challenge some of these no-brainers. And I just think it is the most nuanced way to get the benefits of the ABS system and of the technology we have without really changing too much of the pace or just removing framing value or removing the human element of the game for the people who really love to say that for the umpires. Like, you kind of get the best of all worlds here with this. And I mostly can't wait to see the leaderboards that are made for like best challengers in the game. Like, just guys who have savvy eyes, guys who make the best calls. I know we're going to get some sort of leaderboard to track that. I can't wait to see like who's the best and worst in that category and how teams opt to use their challenges, who's not allowed to challenge at all, how teams use
most
pitchers versus catchers.
Selfish player in the
right
league.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I'm coming up on a contract year, I need to use
my
challenges
arbitration
for myself.
Yeah.
right yeah, so I can't wait for all of those sorts of things about it. And I think for anyone listening, my assumption is our listeners here to this podcast are going to be pretty on board with it. But if you are skeptical and you haven't experienced it at the minor league level, it is, I think, similar to the pitch clock in the sense that it really, you don't notice it. It doesn't feel like it's distracting from the game. It happens really quickly. It is not like a normal replay process where you challenge, the umps walk off the field, you talk about it, you go, you have to wait, hear from a booth or something. Like, it happens immediately. The Hawkeye system, you know the pitches basically in real time. It takes about 15 seconds. There's a cool visual on the scoreboard, so everyone in the stadium can see exactly where the pitch was. I just think it's a really, really good system, and I'm excited for it. What about you?
People are going to like it. That's not even a prediction. We already know. Yep. MLB has tested this system in the minor leagues. The teams like it. The players like it. The fans like it. And they've experimented with different iterations of the ABS going back more than half a decade now. So it's not like something that they're rushing out there. If anything, they probably could have moved even faster, but it is a significant change. I get that they want to be more judicious in how they roll it out, but it works. It doesn't slow the game down. That speed aspect is very important. Nobody wants to be waiting around for 45 seconds, a minute every time somebody challenges a call. It's very quick, and it works the way that you as a fan or as a member of the team would want the system to work. The team is the one that gets to make the decision on which pitches to challenge. You don't want MLB or someone in New York or Secaucus to be making the decisions on which pitches should get challenged. Otherwise, you still have the team saying, hey, why didn't they challenge this call or that pitch went against us? You have control over those decisions as a team. And if you're correct in your challenge, then great. It helps your team get more calls correct. And if you're wrong twice, then you're done. No more for the rest of the game, or at least until we get into extra innings. So we can't just be throwing out challenges on every call. If you're like 30-70 that you think the ump got the call wrong, or if you do, you just risk running out of challenges pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that last piece is like, if I have one quibble with how they're rolling it out, I do think that extra inning rule is something that I would change or just take away entirely. The way it's written right now is in each extra inning, a team will be awarded a challenge if it has none remaining entering the inning. I'd rather just scrap that. Or I think you had a nice alternative as well. Just both teams get an extra one regardless of what they've used, because the way it's ruled or the way it's written now, you're almost rewarding teams who are either not efficient with their challenges or who are just overly aggressive in using them. I do think it's going to be a skill and a real value add for teams who are good at knowing when to challenge and how to challenge. And ideally, you want to challenge as much as possible on calls that are going to help your team. Like, you don't want to just hold all of your challenges back in reserve, because you want to alter every situation on these borderline calls to put yourself in the best position to have a positive outcome within an at bat. So I don't think it's as simple as saying, oh, like all you're doing is not hurting the teams who are just holding back their challenges. You want to be challenging aggressively and often if you're right. And so by just giving teams an extra challenge, if they've used both of theirs, and again, the way it works is you have two challenges, you only lose the challenge if you get it wrong. So you could theoretically challenge 10 times in a game, get them all right. That's a lot of great value you've added to your team because you understand the strike zone. So I think it would be a little bit more interesting if it was just you get two and when you run out, you're done. Or I like your recommendation in our Slack channel. You basically said, what if both teams just got an extra one regardless of whether or not you had it? Because imagine if you just are a team who's bad at challenging, you use both your challenges, you get them wrong. There's another team that you've used yours successfully. You have two. Like, that's an advantage that I think you should take into extra innings. In the same way that when you go into extra innings, MLB is not saying, oh, you both get an extra pitcher now because we're in extra innings. Like, if your starter was really efficient and worked deep into the game versus another team who had to work through a lot of pitchers, you're still playing the same game. You have to deal with what happened earlier. So that would be like, and this is a very minor quibble, I'm kind of ranting a little bit here, I don't think it's a huge deal at all, but that's maybe the one thing I would change if I was in charge.
Yeah, from a fairness perspective, you do have a point. Like, the team that blows through all of its challenges, they get rewarded in extra innings, while the team that was successful in its challenges still has one or two remaining, let's say. Like, they get penalized essentially. So yeah, one could make the argument that you should get both a reset and a carryover. Mm. Yeah, with that, what they could do is give every team an additional challenge at the start of every extra inning, which, you know, they're doing that in this system, but they also they could have any remaining challenges carry over instead of resetting each team's challenges. So once you finish nine innings, yeah, every team then could get an extra challenge for each extra inning. So if you finish nine innings and you've burned through all your challenges, then you still have one challenge in each extra innings, which is what we have in 2026. But you could also let those teams carry over any remaining challenges. So you keep some reward for finishing the first nine innings with one or two challenges in your pocket, because then you start the 10th with two challenges if you finished regulation with one, or three if you finished with two. Otherwise, it's a waste to finish nine innings with your challenges still remaining.
And I'm assuming the reason they did this is because, like, extra innings are going to have maybe a greater degree of magnitude. You don't want to have some, like, obviously wrong call botching an extra inning game. That always feels more bad. But I would say, like, the value of getting the call right in the 10th is the same as getting the call right in the first, like the way our minds work, we're going to just put more leverage or more impact on when it happens later in the game. But if you can help yourself out or avoid an issue earlier in the game, that could maybe just help you avoid going to extra innings in the first place. So I don't really personally buy too much into the like, oh, we definitely need to get them right in extras versus like not wanting to get them right to the same degree in the first five innings. But I can see where people maybe feel differently. But again, minor quibble. I'm really excited for the system. I think people are going to like it.
Yeah. As a team or as a fan of a team or even just as a neutral party watching the games, like the calls that you want to see get challenged will generally get challenged, right? Those calls that are borderline in the most important situations, those calls will get challenged. That's what you want to mm-hmm. see. Now, if you run out of challenges, sure, you know, you're out of luck, but that's on you
yep.
as a team to be intelligent with how you're using your challenges early in the game and to be on the right side of those challenges so that you're not losing them for later on.
Yeah, two things that JJ wrote about that I think are going to be good additions that I don't know if are like immediately obvious from this are he said, expect less arguing over calls. You kind of briefly mentioned this as well when we were talking about it. But now that you can challenge a call, you're going to get a lot less of the bickering back and forth between managers and umpires, between hitters and umpires. Because if the ump is sitting there and makes a call and you don't like it, hey, you can challenge it. And if you weren't convicted enough that the call was wrong, that you were not willing to challenge it, okay, that tells us that you weren't as confident as you're acting. So you're not going to get a lot of complaining. This has happened in the minor leagues. There's a lot less bickering about the zone. And then also...
Wait, do you think that will still happen after a team is out of challenges? If like the manager...
I'm sure, because like if you can't actually challenge it, you're going to resort to just influencing the umpire in the only way you can, which is just complaining to them.
If you're the umpire, like, you're just going to bark back and say... You were wrong twice.
Y'all clearly don't know the zone. Yeah, y'all don't know the zone. What are you coming to me for? I think the fact that you basically like the umpire essentially is in a position where like they have to call your bluff now. Like you put your money where your mouth is essentially. So I think like a lot of that is just going to go away. And it does seem like this will help hitters. Like if we're looking at this on a spectrum of like, will it benefit pitchers more? Will it benefit hitters more? We've seen that it benefits hitters more because pitchers right now in the major leagues, they get calls that benefit them on the edges of the zone much more frequently than happens in AAA. The batters at the major league level have an excellent understanding of the strike zone. Like there are so many situations where hitters are being put into negative counts because they took a ball that was actually off the plate that they were pretty confident was off the plate, but the umpire calls it. The hitters are going to take advantage of this early on. The umpires will make the adjustments when they keep getting calls in those spots overturned. So the zone is going to be smaller for hitters. So pitchers are going to have to much more frequently attack the zone. Hopefully that leads to just more action, more balls in play, more offense. Every rule, or not every rule, but like player development has slanted far more towards the pitching side. And I do think a lot of the on-field rules we've implemented in recent years have tried to balance that out. And I think the ABS challenge system is just going to be another one that is going to be a tool that is a little bit more impactful for the hitters. And I think that's a good thing.
And there's going to be a lot of different strategic elements that teams are going to have to pour over and go over. Like the teams, whether it's the manager, the front office, or ideally some collaborative effort, are going to have to educate their players on strategies of when to challenge. Because we've talked before about how like certain hitters are going to have more liberal green lights from their team to challenge. Like Juan Soto, it's probably like, whenever you want to challenge, like you're probably right. Mm-hmm. So we trust you, right? Then others are going to have a lot less leeway. But you're going to see... And we have the data that supports this from the minor leagues where, and it's not the same as the majors because wins and losses aren't as important in the minor leagues, but we see the count with the highest percentage of challenge calls is the 3-2 count. Because mm-hmm. if it's a borderline call, it's the difference between a walk and a strikeout.
Right.
So two strike calls in general, that's where you're going to see the most challenges because teams are going to be smart enough to say, hey, like outs are baseball's currency. That's where the most is at stake in those counts. I think the one exception might be 0-2 counts. Now, it depends on the specifics of the game and what exact, like what's happening. But if we're in, the third inning, it's a tie game, your six hole hitter is up leading off an inning, and he strikes out looking on an 0-2 pitch, I don't know. Are you challenging that? Like, I want you to be 80, 90% certain it was a ball before your challenge. If you're 50-50, that's not enough for me to get to a 50% chance of moving it to a 1-2 count. So teams are going to have detailed plans for individual hitters, for batter pitcher matchups, for count states, for base out states.
Yeah.
So if it's the second inning, tie game, you have two outs, it's a 1-1 count, borderline pitch is a called strike. Do you want your eight hole hitter challenging that just to like hopefully tick the count in your favor to get ahead instead of behind, but with two outs and nobody on base? So I think teams are just going to have to educate hitters and catchers, who I think will probably have more leeway than the pitchers.
I would hope so, because they're like, they're going to be back there the whole game. You don't run into the issue where it's like, all right, well, this is my only inning. I would think they have a better macro feel. They're like actually right there, so they have theoretically the best view of the zone of anyone on the field, umpire, hitter, pitcher, anyone, less bias. I actually would be really, if I was a team, I would want my players to be extremely aggressive early in the season in making challenges, because I would want to find out, like, where is the line? Like, who are the players we actually can be a little bit more lenient with and letting them challenge? Like, I think you're going to need to find out a lot of this. I'm not sure if it's necessarily just like look at their plate discipline numbers and you automatically have a sense for who is going to be the best at challenging. Maybe to the extremes you'll know, but I would want to be as aggressive as possible in challenging early, because if you find out that like your team or your players just generally are right when they want to challenge, I would want to impact the game as frequently as I can. Like, theoretically, you've got unlimited challenges if you're hitting on them over and over again. And so whether that's spring training being really aggressive or early in the season being really aggressive, like, find out what the line is so you can go up to it as much as you possibly can to eke out as much value from the system. I would not want to be in a situation where I was erring on the conservative side at the start. I would want to be as aggressive as possible. And if I was over challenging early, then so be it. I would rather err on that side than err on the side of caution and not challenge enough, because like getting into positive counts from either side is what you're trying to do within every at bat. And the more you can influence that in your favor, the better. So I would really let my players go kind of wild with it, honestly, early, unless I just had someone like, I don't know, like Michael Harris or Sidani or Rafael or Peter Armstrong, who just swing at everything. But I do wonder if there are going to be players who swing at everything because they have good contact skills, but kind of know they're expanding the zone. Like who is the player who has the highest out of the zone swing rate, who's actually really good at making challenges? I think will be really interesting.
My guess is it probably will correlate to walk rate too.
I think so.
Like Gabriel Moreno swings at a lot of stuff out of the zone. He doesn't strike out a lot, but I don't know. And he's a catcher, so he's an interesting case for that. I think I wouldn't be as aggressive as you are early in the season. I think teams are going to need to educate and train hitters. Like, you could probably just do this in the cage using TrackMan.
Teams already do this.
But for the challenge system specifically, to think I'm talking about thinking probabilistically, which I understand, like, that's hard to do in real time.
No, I do not want my players. No, I don't want them in the weeds this much with the math. No shot.
Oh, no. Yeah. You can say on a scale of 1 to 10 or 1 to 5.
I don't want them thinking probabilistically. If I need to get that much in the weeds, I just need to say, okay, generally, we're not challenging in these counts. Two strikes, you're more able to challenge. But I don't want to throw too many like math issues at them.
No, it's not.
Hitters are
like,
such instinctive
not
hitters anyway. It's like,
they're not, I'm not asking them to calculate physics equations in the box, dude. I'm talking about how certain are you that that was a missed call, right? Some situation.
They're always going to overstay their confidence.
Right. So that's why you have to work at it and have them practice. So like if you're 40% certain, like these guys, especially the guys who've been doing this for, you know, if you're a 19-year-old, just, you know, in your first season out of high school, like I don't expect you to have a sense for that, but I'm pretty sure.
They also have to learn the pro zone. So
sure. But the guys who've been in the big leagues for years have a pretty sharp sense of it. Like these guys aren't just like, all a bunch of dummies up there. So like if you're 40% certain a situation, like it might still be worth challenging. Others, the bar might be 70-30, 80-20 or even higher for when to pull the trigger on it.
Okay, who are some of your players you think, assuming we're going to have leaderboards to track this, who would be non-Juan Soto tier that are going to be at the top of the, like, okay, these guys are really good at a challenge.
So I think Juan Soto will be toward the top.
He should be.
But yeah. I also, here's the other thing though. I think Juan Soto should be more liberal in the pitches that he challenges.
Just so because he's a better hitter?
Because he's a better hitter. So like if Luis Angel Acuña is up there, like,
do we really want him optimizing his count? Right.
Yeah. Like, I don't, you know, I'm not just picking on him, but like, you know, somebody who's not, whoever's hitting toward the bottom of their lineup should not be getting the same amount of leeway as Juan Soto or Cal Raleigh or Aaron Judge. Like those guys, like if you swing a count in Aaron Judge's favor from 1-2 to 2-1, like, okay, that makes a material difference and a much bigger impact than, you know, for whoever's hitting at the bottom of your lineup. So I actually expect those guys, maybe on a percentage basis, to not necessarily be as good, even if
their just because sense you've said like we want you to challenge more, so we will accept a lower percentage from you so you can have more chances to change the game state of your AB. That makes a ton of sense to me.
Yeah, if you're running an 85 WRC plus for the season, like I want you challenging me again, like certain situations, 3-2 pitch, bases loaded, whatever, like okay, fine. Otherwise, that better be a terrible call that you're challenging on.
Right.
Whereas Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, like if you think it might be wrong, but like the situation is right, like go ahead. Like we'd rather, well, we're willing to have you be wrong and in case you might be right and give you a little bit of a boost here in the count.
I've got a few players who I think will be really good at this. And I want to throw them out and get your thought. I don't think any of them are like shocking, but these are the three that I look at. I'm like, yeah, I can't wait for them to be able to challenge pitches. The first that I thought of, I think a few years ago for this, is Evan Carter. I think he will be really good at this, even though
not what I was expecting you were going to say.
Yeah. Evan Carter's one, like for just watching him take ABs, I think there are a lot of, I just think he has a good understanding of the zone. Like he's not like sort of elite walk rate, never strikes out guy, but he's one. The other one that I'd be really excited about for this is Corbin Carroll. I think he would be really, really good at this. And then maybe the most excited is Stephen Kwan. I think Stephen Kwan is going to be a savant at challenging pitches. Again, he's never walked more than 10%. He's never struck out more than 10.4%. So like he just is a guy who makes a lot of contact, but I think that's just sort of his game. But I think he is just such a cerebral baseball player. I think he really does understand the zone. I just think he's going to be really, really good at this. So if I had to like non-Juan Soto version, someone I had to just put my chips in and say, this guy's going to be great at challenging, I would say Kwan.
Yeah, I was going to say Ohtani because he's just good at everything.
Yeah, pretty good one. I'm actually curious what his play discipline numbers are because he doesn't jump off the page.
He walks a lot.
In terms of, I was looking at like outside of the zone swing rate and swing rates overall. So now I'm just kind of curious what that number is for him. Okay. Yeah, he should have shown up. He was just off the like top 30 of qualified hitters. So his out of the zone swing rate is 26.1%. All the top 30 players in baseball this year are at 26% or less. Juan Soto tops the list at 18%. So yeah, he does walk a lot. He swings a lot more than you'd expect for someone who walks a ton.
He's
good.
I'm not betting against him.
Shohei Ohtani, good at baseball. You heard it here first. Cool. I mean, any guys that you would never let them challenge? Is there anyone that you think has such atrocious play discipline, swing decisions that you're just like, it's a no-go? We don't have to bang on these guys too bad, but
no, I'm thinking like we're talking about like Moreno, like Salvador Perez. That's an interesting one as a catcher who is such
just swings a ton.
Who's such a free swinger? Like, I don't know. And he's a veteran. Like, how much do you tell him?
Right. Oh, that's kind of an interesting factor too. Like, how much is like veteran? It shouldn't matter at all, but I wonder if, like, if you're a rookie, are you going to be a lot, or if you're not sure if your spot on the team is solidified, you're like an up and down type. Are you like, I'm not going to mess this up. I'm not going to take away these challenges from the stars of the team or the veterans on the team. That whole dynamic will be really interesting. It's going to be fun. I just think it's going to add a layer, like a strategic layer to the game that will be fun to watch in real time. You know, like it's just a fun other wrinkle. And I hope too, I don't know if we've seen anything about this, but I really hope they get rid of the strike zone overlays with this, because it would also just make the game a little bit more interactive when you're watching. If you're like, that was definitely a ball, like as a viewer having to actually like have some conviction in what you think. Cause I think in general, I've mentioned this before, but like the strike zone overlay makes people far more confident in their understanding of what's a ball and a strike. There's a lot of like 50-50 calls that happen. And I think the strike zone overlay just removes that from most fans. So I hope that goes away, because it also adds a little bit more drama to the challenge call itself. If you've already seen on the overlay, and the overlay is pretty consistent with the ABS, which I don't know if that will actually be the case, but I think it'll make it more fun from a viewer experience. But that's my last comment about the ABS.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Okay. I think we do have a question today, Ben, that we can get in here. Definitely feels addressed to you. Jacob Larson on X/Twitter says, with the impending departure of Carlos Rodriguez from the Rays, will the Rays see noticeable changes in international free agent spending, and who runs their IFA scouting now?
Yeah, so I saw the report from Mark Topkin, who said that Carlos Rodriguez, who's one of the AGMs with the Rays, is leaving the organization. Sounds like it's his decision. He's been with the Rays for 15 years, worked in international scouting for a long time for Tampa, took over as their Latin American scouting director in 2012, got a promotion to international scouting director in 2015, held that role through 2019, got promoted to VP of player development and international scouting from 2019 through 2021. Then in 2022, became VP of baseball ops. After that season, promoted again, got a VP/AGM title. So that's a lot of promotions for him. He's obviously heavily influential in the team's international scouting from 2012 through 2019 and then through 21 as well, still VP of international scouting at that time, in addition to his work in PD. So like, you know, Christopher Sanchez, probably the best Latin American pitcher in baseball now, signed under his watch. Pretty much any Latin American player who came through the Rays farm system in the last decade. I did go to his bio page on the Rays website, and they list 10 prominent signings who signed during his tenure, and notably absent from that page, Wander Franco. So I guess the Rays are just scrubbing any reference to him, but he obviously played a big role in shaping their international scouting and international development processes over the last 10, 15 years. But his role really shifted into higher level baseball operations decisions over the last few years, like the last 3 to 5 years. So I think it's definitely a loss for the Rays to no longer have him in the organization. But I don't know that you would see a huge change in the Rays international signings, because he just wasn't like super heavily involved in the day-to-day down there. In recent years, I mean, Steve Miller is their international scouting director, and he's been in that role going back to 2019 now. So, and he'd been working with Carlos as an international cross-checker for 6 years before that. Really sharp scout, good eye for talent. Patrick Walters is their international, like a director of international operations. So he's been with the Rays for a long, long time, working with them as well, going back like 15 years. So Danny Santana is one of their top scouts in the DR. He works like 8 days a week. He's been with the Rays forever. So I don't know. I mean, obviously everyone's different. Just because people have worked together for a long time doesn't mean they think identically or have the exact same philosophies. But I don't know that you would see some major change on the international signing side specifically, largely just that hasn't been Rodriguez's chief responsibility for the last few years. And then look, the, like the other thing too, is just like these teams have agreements in place for players, like pretty much all of them do, for 2026, 2027, 2028, even 29 and beyond. So especially the next couple years, I don't think you'll see any major changes for them. I also really like their international class from this year. I wrote up a story on 9 international signings or international signing classes for 2025 that stood out, and I didn't have the Rays in there. There were a couple others or a few others that I thought could have been included in there. Two of them were just like, you know, the Blue Jays, Braves. Blue Jays signed Juan Sanchez, Braves signed Diego Tornes, and those were two of the elite prospects in the DSL, but for the most part focused on deeper classes. And I think the Rays were one that could have fit in that group. Like, you've got Michael Corrett, who's this 6'4", highly athletic center fielder, lots of space to fill out, lots of tools, solid performance, but not as good as, you know, say Elian Pena with the Mets, or Sanchez with the Blue Jays, or Joswar Gonzalez with the Giants. The strikeouts for Corrett were on the higher side, but not crazy high either. Warel Solano was another one of their 7-figure signings. He's intriguing. Emmanuel Cedeno is a shortstop or an infielder they signed with super low swing and miss. It's like 48 walks, 12 strikeouts, crazy numbers. He's just 5'9", minimal power, mostly played second base, but he's intriguing. So is Ivan Torres, a catcher they signed out of Venezuela. He had 20 walks, 12 strikeouts, high OBP. Another sleeper to keep tabs on. So they didn't have that one big headliner, although maybe Michael Corrett turns into that guy in a year or two, like at least as far as like if we're looking at where they are at right now. But it was a quality mix of especially position prospects in particular who are going to be guys to watch next year in when they come to the Florida Complex League.
Well, there you go, Jacob. And the best answer you could have possibly gotten from that question, and a reminder that Ben Badler is the GOAT in terms of international prospect coverage. So you came to the right spot. Thank you, Ben, for all that insight, because you're not getting that sort of depth and nuance anywhere else. So kudos to you, my friend. But that's all we had for today. But you got any final comments?
Just gearing up for Braves Pirates this finish it out.
The race for 9.24% draft odds in the draft lottery. Top story in baseball.
I know. I'm getting sick of seeing it plastered all over the MLB social media feeds. They just keep hammering it home with us.
Cool. Well, that is episode 138 of Future Projection. Thank you guys for hanging out with us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the site, supporting Baseball America and everything we do. We really cannot do all the stuff we do without readers, subscribers, supporters, people like you who allow us to do this. So thank you guys for the support. For Ben, I'm Carlos. We'll see you guys next time. So long.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.